Chapter 2, The Depression Years. Everyone has their version of those Depression years, and the young people today so scoff at our tales. It's all so unbelievable. Today's young people have never been hungry, nor have they shivered in homes through the winter, where we just could not afford to have coal enough to bring our hand-fired stoves or furnaces up to livable temperatures. Nor have they walked down cold streets shivering because they just did not have enough warm clothes. In those years, your fathers picked up their gun and went out in the woods and shot deer out of season, and the game wardens didn't see a thing. We joked about lignite coal. Grandmothers or mothers or children would take that little child's wagon down to those enormous coal docks on the waterfront in Duluth and Superior and pile the wagon high with coal in the middle of the night and truck it home, and the watchman on the dock somehow never saw them. Those watchmen had terrible eyesight. I don't know how they kept their jobs. They couldn't see a thing. Of course, if a truck had driven up, they would have seen that. In the wintertime, we drove on the ice crossing the bay between Duluth and Superior, avoiding paying that 15-cent toll if we drove across the interstate bridge. The city of Superior even sent a snowplow out to make a road across the ice. And people could not pay their taxes as they had no job, so the city of Superior had no money to pay city employees, so the city printed its own money and paid employees with that. It was called scrip. Superior merchants would accept that scrip, but Duluth merchants would not. Half of my salary was in scrip, but I did not mind. I was living in Superior then. I wished I had saved a bit of that scrip to look at today, but I did not. No one was able to save anything. We lived from paycheck to paycheck. When there were serious forest fires near town, there was no highly organized forestry department, as we have today. Instead, the sheriff would go down to the lower part of town, and when he came across a man that was loafing, that fellow would get a tap on the shoulder, and he would be told he was now a firefighter. That, or go to jail. Fighting fire seemed to him to be more desirable, but not much more. I was lucky. I had stable employment all through those years. I was earning $40 a week, which was considered good pay for an executive vice president in charge of engineering of the Arrowhead Network. Of course, living costs were not as high then as now. Eggs cost 12 cents a dozen, milk was 8 cents a quart, and bread 9 cents, and $30 covered the cost of groceries for a family of four for a month. But that was not much in the way of groceries either, and we were all a little starved and lean. There were few fatties in our society those days. A banker friend of mine once told me he had grown up on a farm in North Dakota, and he knew children on the next farm had died of starvation. The family could not raise enough food on their farm, and there were no jobs in town, so the family ate less and less, and the weaker children faded away from malnutrition. This in America. But it was not all sadness. Actually, we were happy. Neighbors got to know neighbors, and we visited with people a lot and got to really know each other. We did not get in a car and rush off to some other place, leaving us strangers in our own neighborhood. Employment at WEBC and at the Associated Network Station was stable. There was not constant change of personnel as we have today. We got to know each other, but almost all are gone now. I am one of the few remaining. Each summer brought polio, and we parents lived in terror of this crippling disease. A fever, and then arms and legs were paralyzed for a lifetime. President Roosevelt was stricken and limped through his life. It seemed to almost always strike only children, and how we dreaded those summer days. Medicine was advancing, and years later, during the war, penicillin became known. My pharmacy son, Gary, tells me that at one time the world's entire supply of penicillin was in one bedpan in a London hospital during the war. Different molds were being grown, and doctors noticed the particular mold in this bedpan killed germs. Research immediately focused on it, and today's life-giving penicillin is saving millions of lives. When I was 23 years old, in 1932, I had my appendix removed. I had not been able to keep anything down for a week, and that night, about 11 p.m., old Doc Giesen knocked on my door at home and told me I was to have my appendix removed, and now. I got in his car, and we drove to that tiny Catholic hospital in Superior and up in the operating room on the top floor. It was a small room with dark brown walls and a single 100-watt electric bulb dangling from the ceiling. I lay on a small operating table while Doc rolled up his sleeves and went over to a small sink on the wall and washed his hands. No rubber gloves, just bare hands. He stuck a needle in my spine, which must have been a spinal anesthetic. It must have been new in those days. Then he stretched me out on the table, with him standing on one side and a Catholic sister on the other side. They talked across me, talking about hunting, as it was fall and hunting time. After a bit, Doc picked up a scalpel and made a cut, asking me if I felt it. I said I did. So he put the scalpel down and continued to talk. A bit more, and he tried the scalpel again, and I said I did not feel it. So he cut me open and pulled out my intestine as I watched, looking down. There was no screen between me and the operation. He snipped off a bit of intestine and held it up, saying, "This is what was giving you your trouble, Charlie." He then sewed me up and wheeled me down to a room and went home. It had been a long day for him. The anesthetic wore off and the pain came, and hours later a nurse wandered in and I begged her for a hypo, which I got. Then came days of pain and asking for hypos, which she was very reluctant to give. After 4 or 5 days in the hospital, I went home, and a couple of days after, I was back on the job. We were a tough people in those days. Later, a friend of mine had an appendix burst, filling his abdomen with deadly poison. I visited him on that hot July day and found him sweltering in the heat with a bit of rubber tubing running from a hole in his abdomen down to a glass jar on the floor, draining the poison. The heat and the odor of that poison was overwhelming. He survived, but just barely. Today, when I see television pictures of operating rooms with many gowned surgeons and nurses and lots of big machinery around, and cannot help but remember way back then, we have come so far. It is the year 1928, and I thought I should have an engineer's license. I already had a radio amateur license, having gotten that at the age of 15 back there in Wisconsin, where I had passed an exam given by mail by the Department of Commerce out of Chicago. They had given me the call 9CGP, but although I could receive on amateur frequencies, I could not transmit as there was no electric power in that tiny village, and you cannot transmit very far with power you get from kerosene lamps. Now I am to get an engineer's license. On that day, a man from the Department of Commerce in Chicago got on a train and traveled all night to Duluth. He gave the exam to three of us young fellows in the courthouse that morning. The other two are interested in only wireless, as they plan to be wireless operators on the ships that ply the Great Lakes. But we all take exactly the same exam. First, we must demonstrate that we can send and receive international Morse code at the rate of 20 words per minute. Then we sit down to write the exam, which deals entirely with wireless receivers, wireless transmitters, shipboard installations, wireless laws. Nothing about radio broadcasting. Although the department was responsible for broadcasting, they knew nothing about it and preferred to pretend it did not exist. We started writing at about 9 a.m. About noon, the other two were through writing and left. But I kept on writing. I wrote everything I knew about wireless, and I repeated myself several times. The examiner kept looking over my shoulder, wondering when I would get through. He had a train to catch and wanted to get back to Chicago. Finally, I handed in my papers, at least half an inch thick or more, and I left. He went back to Chicago and graded papers. I'm sure he did not read mine. There was too much, and besides, no one can read my handwriting anyway. He must have just picked up that pile of papers and said to himself, "Gee, this guy must know a lot. 97%. He could not give me a mark of 100% because no one can be perfect, not even Charlie Persons. But you notice, I came close. Now I am an engineer, a wireless engineer. I never set forth in a wireless station in my life and never will, but now I can legally attend the WEBC transmitter, and I can go over to Superior and spell off Walter Bridges, which I do. A year or two later, I do go over to Superior, and I live in that penthouse transmitter room. I have a folding cot, which I unfold at night for sleeping. The bathroom is downstairs in the newspaper part of the building. For breakfast, I sit on the edge of my cot and munch a couple day-old donuts obtained at the bakery across the street. At noon, a bowl of soup and a slice of toast. But in the evening, I really splurge. I walk down Tower Avenue to Gurney's Cafe and order their 25-cent special of meatloaf and all the fixings. I'm 6 feet tall and weigh 130 pounds. In 1938, I moved my office to the WEBC offices on the top floor of the WEBC building at 4th Avenue West and Superior Street in downtown Duluth. From then on, I was there as WEBC was the flagship station of the Arrowhead Network, and I worked for the network. In fact, I built the network. That was my job. But being at WEBC gave me more knowledge of that station than other network stations. Memories flood in on me of people and events. Here are some of them. Drifting into town one day was Prince Yoko, who answered your letters over the air. When would your husband come home? Where was that ring you lost? Would your daughter pass that next exam at school? All the listener had to do was write the prince a letter, and also please enclose a quarter. He could see the future better if he had that quarter in his hand. The prince always came in the studio wearing a long flowing gown and a turban. Before each program, one of us would sit down at the table with the prince and we would open the letters together with quarters tumbling out. The quarters were neatly piled in two piles, his and WEBC's, equally. Then he went on the air. Also coming into town was that electronic genius Professor Alfonso, who brought with him a large horse collar of coiled wire, which you draped over your body, and then it was plugged in an electric field that saturated your body, which would cure you of anything that ailed you, even those ingrown toenails that you had been carrying around for years. For just $14.50, one of these marvelous healing machines could be yours. His program consisted mostly of reading testimonial letters from happy customers, letters he most likely wrote to himself the evening before in his hotel room. Then there was that time when there was that statewide convention of men, legion or something, and the town and the hotel were running over with fun-loving men. That afternoon, looking out from our penthouse window, we looked across the inner courtyard of the hotel and we saw a winsome lass, completely naked, standing in the window of her room, waving at fellows in windows all around, inviting them to come in and visit with her. I do not recall any of our ogling staff going over to visit her, and the incident passed. One does remember so many things. Then there was that weekly program called Name That Tune, in which listeners tried to stump the WEBC orchestra by naming a tune and challenging the orchestra to play that tune. If the orchestra could not, the listeners won a beautiful blanket. In the early days of the program, letters were opened and read on the air. With many bewildering tunes, the orchestra knew existed, but they did not know how to play the tune, and blankets were being given away like mad. The program sponsor, who supplied the blankets, was horrified and descended on the station demanding a change of format. After that, the letters were opened before the program, although appearing to be opened on the program, and tunes were selected and rehearsed, with no more than two or three blankets being given away each program. Curtains were drawn over the studio windows during such rehearsals, so those walking down the hall could not look in the studio and spy on the rehearsal in progress. In those glamour days of radio, when WEBC occupied an entire floor of the WEBC building in downtown Duluth, the station had a full-time orchestra, with a musical program or two every evening. John Clive was the leader of the orchestra, a happy individual, happy until a trip to the clinic in Rochester revealed he had inoperative cancer. He stopped leading the orchestra, but did visit the station from time to time, coming in my office, sitting there crying. The pain and terror of the disease overwhelmed him as I tried to find words to comfort him. On his last visit to the station, he lay on a Davenport in the lobby, as the staff awkwardly stood around him, fumbling for words. Then he stayed home, but his terror was so great the family could not cope with him, so he was sent to the hospital for the final 2 weeks. There, a couple of days before the final moment, his attitude completely changed, and he became calm and smiling. God's way of making the transition from here to there a happy one. Then there was H.E. Wes Westmoreland, a brilliant manager of WBC for a number of years, a fastidious and meticulous man who insisted his office be a showplace for his customers to enjoy when they came to discuss contracts. To that end, he closed the Venetian blind, shutting out the harsh sunlight, and with carefully placed floor and table lamps, made a beautiful, cozy office to impress and soothe customers. One day, the boss stopped by, walked in Wes's office, pulled up the blinds, and turned off the lamps, leaving a normal-looking office like his own. This so dismayed Wes, he shortly after left WBC and established his own advertising firm on Michigan Street, where he could design his office with no bosses to come around. But the lighting scheme was not the only cross Wes had to bear. There was his secretary, Helen Larson, a good Swede who always had the coffee pot on in her office through which everyone visiting Wes had to walk through. Thus, the odor of brewing coffee greeted every visitor to Wes's office, with Wes's lips curling in disdain. But Helen was too valuable an employee to fire, so Wes endured her until, in the end, he left her behind as he went into his own Michigan Street office, where there was no coffee pot. After Wes came Earl Hinton, who was a well-established radio and TV personality in Duluth. Earl had no stomach for management duties, but gracefully accepted this brief stint as manager until a more permanent man was found. Came the day when a very important executive with the NBC network in New York came to Duluth to negotiate a new network contract with WEBC. The receptionist was in the washroom, or somewhere, and by chance, I was in the station lobby, and volunteered to take this impeccably dressed New Yorker to the manager. And I found Earl in the secretary's office flat on his back underneath a desk, inserting screws in the bottoms of a typewriter, with only his feet sticking out from under the desk. I kicked his feet and said, "Hey, manager, here's a visitor to see you." Earl crawled out and met the visitor. And when the NBC executive got back to his office in New York, he confirmed to his co-workers the suspicion they always had. The Midwest people are all a little strange. As I walked down the hall late that afternoon, there in front of me fell WEBC salesman John Stack from the secretary's office out in the hall. My thought that the horseplay we were so used to there was getting a little too rough. As I knelt over John, he didn't look right, like this was more than just fainting. The ambulance was called, and they showed up almost instantly, along with the police. A policeman told me John had not fainted, but he obviously had a heart attack and was dead before he hit the floor. But the body was not moved immediately, pending a police investigation. Someone ran to the coat closet, got a coat, and threw it over the body. A bit later, I was ready to go home, but could not find my coat, and then did find it over John's body. I picked up my coat, shook it, put it on, and went home. It had been quite a day. And NBC star Lowell Thomas came to town on a lecture tour, and that one evening put his nightly 6 to 6:15 news period on the network from the WEBC studio. The WEBC disc jockeys were quite impressed as they observed Thomas spend the entire day sorting out and rehearsing this 15-minute news program. The WEBC men were what is known as rip-and-read artists, who would rip the news off the news machine, run in the studio, and read it on the air without having read it over. There was some reason why Lowell Thomas was a nationally known news commentator. This, I suspect, was the reason. WEBC news announcers did not sit down to read their several times a day 15-minute news broadcast. Instead, they stood by the microphone in the middle of the studio, Sometimes a coworker would silently slip in the studio in the middle of the announcer's newscast, unbuckle the announcer's belt, and let his trousers fall to the floor, leaving the poor announcer standing all in his glory in shorts to the amusement of those walking by in the hall. A favorite trick played on new control room engineers, it was the mic check trick, where we went in the studio, stood by the mic, pretending to say words, going through the motions, but silently saying nothing, as the poor engineer frantically threw switches, wondering why the sound did not come out. So was the delightful horseplay that went on at the WEBC office. But I was an engineer and responsible for the engineering at all the Arrowhead Network stations. After building the stations, I had to keep all stations supplied with replacement parts, including the Type 891 and 892 water-cooled 5,000-watt transmitting tubes. The WEBC transmitter in Duluth used three of these tubes. So did the WEAU Eau Claire transmitter. They cost $1,200 each, even in those depression days. Through the years, I always purchased those tubes from RCA. No one called on me. I just mailed in my orders. Then one day, in walks Jim Crossman, who represented Federal Telephone and Telegraph Company, and he is selling those tubes at the same price. Why buy from Jim? Well, there developed a reason. Jim was a broadcast station engineer, and each time he visited me, we talked about engineering problems. Once he took off his suit coat and spent an evening working on the WEBC transmitter with me. Then came the day when I needed some of those big tubes, so I said to Jim, "Send me a couple." And from then on, I purchased all those tubes from Jim, and he continued to visit me, and we talked engineering. One day, I telephoned Hugh McCartney, who was the engineer for Giant WCCO in the Twin Cities. And in the course of our conversation, he mentioned he was purchasing his transmitting tubes from Federal Telephone and Telegraph Company, and I asked, "Why?" There was a pause, and he said, "Well, I guess it's because of Jim Crossman." I remember the story of the president of a national advertising agency who very much wanted the advertising account of a national candy company. He did not go to the president of the candy company with an impressive sales pitch. Instead, he went to the candy factory and learned all he could about candy making and distribution. It was then he called on the president of the candy company, and they sat and talked for hours about the problems of manufacturing and distribution of candy. And the advertising man walked out with the advertising contract. I used to tell these stories to the KVBR salesman, and it made no impression whatsoever. Instead, they continued to overwhelm prospective customers with clever sales pitches and continued to lose orders to competitors. Then there was Bill Barnes and Earl Almquist, radio personalities at WEBC in Duluth, who roomed together in a tiny apartment on Park Point. These were the innocent days before World War II, when homosexuality was unheard of, and no one gave a second thought about two grown men living together. On this morning, Earl got up early and quietly put some newspaper and green leaves in a pail, and with a match got a smoldering fire going with clouds of smoke billowing out. Then he yelled, "Fire!" with Bill bouncing out of bed, running out on the lawn in his pajamas with neighbors looking on, wondering what the crazy radio people were up to now. The WEBC crowd enjoyed telling the story in days to come. So many practical jokes and so much fun. The employment at WEBC was very stable, same people year after year. Although I worked for the Arrowhead Network, my office was always at WEBC, which station, after all, was the flagship station for the network. Such clean-cut and dedicated men and women, almost no drinking, well, a beer or two now and then. As for drugs, they were absolutely unheard of. We did know that Chinese smoked opium in their dens in San Francisco, but they were far away and had no effect on our lives. We were such sweet, innocent people back then. The FCC inspector would make a surprise visit to WEBC every couple of years. I would be with him while he inspected the WEBC plant. The government had so many more strict technical rules then. Evenings, I would turn him over to the sales staff, who saw that he was entertained. Somehow, WEBC never got any discrepancy reports. Then the next day, he and I would drive together to inspect our Iron Range stations, WMFG and WHLB, in Hibbing and Virginia. And again, no discrepancy. And there was the time when he had heard the Hibbing Police Department was operating an unlicensed transmitter. We walked in the police department office, where he flashed his FCC badge and told the police sergeant on duty that they were operating an unlicensed radio transmitter. The sergeant reached over and pulled the plug out of the wall and said, "I never liked this damn thing anyway." Then the police chief rushed in, and they went into a room to talk it over. After we were on our way back to Duluth, I asked the inspector who he was going to arrest for operating an unlicensed transmitter. And the inspector only sighed and said, "It's public service, and we don't arrest anyone." Later, Hibbing did have its first duly licensed radio station, and still has. This was 1937. Bedbugs. Through the many years I have stayed overnight in endless hotel and motel rooms while visiting our Arrowhead Network stations on business trips to the east and all around, and have never run across bedbugs. Well, there was this one time. It was 1937 and I was staying overnight in the Androy Hotel where our station WMFG was located. In the middle of the night, I woke up feeling some insect biting my neck. Groggily, I thought mosquitoes. Then I sat upright. Mosquitoes? In January? I jumped out of bed and found little insects running all around the bed. Bed bugs, beyond question. I took off my PJs and carefully inspected them, then all the clothes in my suitcase. Then I called the front desk and demanded another room. In the new room, I went through everything again, making sure I'd not carried over a bug or two. The next morning, I met Roy Quigley, manager of the hotel, and a friend, and I told him of my experience the night before. He was horrified and said, "That's terrible. It's never happened in my hotel before." Later that morning, I walked by my old room, the bed buggy room, and saw a young man spraying a powder all around. I asked him what was going on. He said, "Bed bugs." I said, "Has this happened before?" And he said, "Oh, yes, every once in a while." How about that, Roy? But then I suppose Roy could not insist that everyone coming up to the front desk asking for a room be stripped and searched right there in the lobby before they were given a room. So Roy had his problems too. In the years that followed, I would always pull aside the bed covers of every room I had just taken, looking for little bugs crawling around. I've never found any. Where have all the bed bugs gone? Time went by and WEBC prospered. Well, sort of. In 1930, the studio on the second floor was moved up to a new penthouse room on the roof of the Spalding Hotel, a large studio and a small office. You took the elevator to the fifth floor and then walked up a flight of stairs to this new elegance. Two or three employees were added to the staff. One was a beautiful blonde whom we knew was also a mistress for a wealthy Duluth businessman. She was always sad, and we felt sorry for her. She deserved better. And along about then, WEBC broadcast the Duluth Symphony Orchestra over the NBC network for an hour, Saturday evenings. We engineers were always very nervous. What would happen if a tube burned out and left 200 radio stations around the country with no sound? Paul LeMay was the conductor. The war came, and he rushed off to serve and never returned. And about this time, the daughters of wealthy Duluth families appeared at WEBC. They had been away at some finishing school and now were back home looking for work. Clerking in a store or in an insurance office did not appeal to them. And here was radio, a glamour occupation. I found myself associating with some mighty high-class talent. I was in good company, even if they weren't. And the station acquired announcers, almost always men. I remember one who incessantly played the record, "I Can't Give You Anything But Love, Baby." Obviously a message to some lass out there in radio land. And considering his salary, I suspect he was being very factual. An hour each afternoon was devoted to announcer Jim Elderkin, reading a chapter or two from a book he held in his hand. It was Story Hour. This feature was years later made into the soap operas we have today. The Depression was in full swing, and our national government was making brave attempts to take care of our people. Several agencies were set up, including the CCC camps, that's Civilian Conservation Corps, where our young people labored improving our national force. The pay was almost nothing, but at least these young people had food and clothing. And one such camp on Madeline Island was out there in Lake Superior, did a broadcast over WEBC every Sunday afternoon. And one such camp on Madeline Island, out there in Lake Superior, did a broadcast over WEBC every Sunday afternoon. It came to us via their low-power shortwave transmitter, and I struggled trying to receive a signal strong enough for a broadcast. The singing and the thin, faraway voices of these sad young men still haunt me. These were unhappy times. WEBC continued along. It was not making any money, but at least it was holding its own, and just maybe there was a future for this new struggling baby. And the boss looked north, where he saw his two newspapers, the one in Hibbing and the other in Virginia, on the rich iron range. Possibly a radio station could survive there. So I was commissioned to locate a radio station between these two 20-mile-apart towns. But I had doubts that a single station, midway there, would have enough signal over two towns to provide easy listening, especially at night when faraway signals came barreling in. So I set up a small transmitter in a midway farmyard and went back and forth across the range, measuring signal strengths, arriving at the conclusion that there was just would not be enough signal in both towns to be of any value. In the farmer's backyard, of course, but not in either Hibbing or Virginia. So the boss did some soul-searching and decided putting a station in Hibbing, the larger of the two towns, would be worth a try. "But don't get in too deep," he said. "We might want to pull out." So my shop went to work manufacturing a transmitter and studio equipment, and then in the summer, my mechanic Earl Olson and I went up to Hibbing and installed the station in the Android Hotel there in the middle of the business district. The industry was still installing radio stations on the roofs of the tallest building in town, so the tower was installed on the roof of the hotel building and the transmitter and studio in the basement. Then, as I was about to connect the basement transmitter to the antenna tower on the roof, the owner of the building announced to me no one was going to run wires down the side of his building. Well, there I sat. No way to connect the studio and the transmitter in the basement to the antenna on the roof. The boss took a very dim view of employees who got themselves into situations like that. It looked like the time had finally come for me to clear out my desk and go away. Then I remembered, hearing about something new and quite revolutionary. It was called coaxial cable, invented by a Chicago firm. Frantic calls to them, and they shipped 150 feet of this new copper cable, and Earl and I snaked it down the elevator shaft connecting the transmitter and the tower antenna, and Viva Station WMFG was on the air, October 2nd, 1935, and I kept my job. One problem. The owner of the theater, a half block down the street, came storming in. Our programs were getting into his sound system and could be distinctly heard in the first six rows of his theater, and now we had better buy out those six rows every showing of the picture. But we did not. I went over to his theater projection room and installed a filter, which removed our programs from all six rows. He was disappointed. Truth is, he never had anyone sitting in those first six rows anyway. In fact, he was having trouble getting anybody to sit down in his theater. There was a depression going on. Didn't he know that? And now, Morgan had a second radio station, and he had the beginning of a network, the Arrowhead Network, as it turned out to be. So, in a burst of enthusiasm, he ordered me to build another station and put it in the other town, Virginia, where he also owned a paper. So, back to my shop, turning out another transmitter and studio equipment. So, in the summer of 1936, Earl and I journeyed up to Virginia and set up another station. And so, WHLB on 1400 kilocycles came on the air, October 12, 1936. The fact that the boss had set up radio stations to compete with his newspapers in these towns bothered him not a bit. The competition would make better men and women of them. Besides, he owned the competition. It was 1929, and Duluth Radio Stores held their annual radio show, showing the latest radio receivers to enthusiastic listeners. It was then I demonstrated television to the Duluth public. Well, sort of. Television was constantly talked about. Some radio receivers even had connectors in back to connect to a television set when it came, which was not to be for another 15 years or more. But the WEBC crowd, in a thoughtless burst of enthusiasm, announced to the world that WEBC was going to show television pictures at the radio show. Having said that, the WEBC boys turned and looked at me and said, "It's your baby now, Charlie." What was I to do? There was my boss, who was prone to believe publicity, especially when it was printed in his newspaper. I had to do something. I dashed down to St. Paul and got from station KSTP a TV scanning disc receiver, which they were experimenting with then, being the leader in the radio station business there. The radio show was held in the Shrine Auditorium there at 2nd Avenue East and 1st Street. I sat this exciting new TV marvel up on the stage and waited for the crowd, but there were no TV pictures to receive. So I got a piece of 35mm movie film showing two people, set it in the machine, and got the 2-foot scanning disc to whirling. Then, by squinting, one could see a postage stamp-sized picture of two people, and lo, that was television. The crowd was lined up and kept moving fast enough so people were not aware that the two people in the picture did not move. Here was fraud in the purest form, and I suppose I could be sued. But if I am, I'll blame it on the boss, and I will even take you out to the cemetery and show you his grave, so you sue him. Later, I was actually to see television. It was in Chicago, and I saw a postage stamp-sized picture of two men that did move. This was real television. No fooling. And even later, I was at the General Electric plant in Schenectady, and their engineers showed me an experimental TV station in operation. But now, the scanning disc was gone, and they were using the Orthicon pickup tube, which required a light so blinding actors could hardly see. The picture was about 4 inches across. This was just before the war. In the early 30s, the big boys in the front office of a group called American Society of Authors and Publishers, ASCAP for short, discovered there was a new thing out there called radio stations that were playing records and using music copyrighted by their group. Oh boy, here was something else they could tax, and they did. At first, radio stations were only annoyed, but then, in a sudden burst of arrogance, the ASCAP boys zoomed up the rate. After all, we own that there music you are using, they said. The radio stations en masse rebelled and refused to play any ASCAP-owned music and played only music that was a part of the public domain, which was a pretty sad bunch of music. Genie with the Light Brown Hair, Ave Maria, and such like. Radio almost died. And radio stations then suddenly joined together searching music libraries for just any kind of music. They did something else. They formed Broadcast Music Incorporated and searched for any kind of music, getting new writers and publishers to join them. It worked. Now ASCAP was faced with an adversary, and they came to the bargaining table in the good faith of the American way. A reasonable tax rate was arrived at, and radio survived. But now broadcasters had a new music licensing office to support, so broadcasters had to chip in. And they then found themselves paying a tax to two groups instead of one. And this is the way it is today. Oh yes, there's another, CSAC. They own a few pieces of music, and a station is not likely to go through a day without playing at least one of their songs. And it's just not worth the bother of sorting out and avoiding using their music, so radio stations pay their small fee without worrying over it. In 1937, the boss looked south and saw the city of Eau Claire, Wisconsin, sitting there with no radio station. Station WTAG had been there, but things did not go well, so they had folded up and had gone away. So I'm told to put a radio station there. And, once again, my shop hums, manufacturing a 1,000-watt transmitter to operate on 1050 kilocycles. Mechanic Earl Olson and myself journey there to install on land I purchased on the south side of town. Engineer Todd Jorgensen came down from Hibbing, and together we soon had the station up and going. Station WEAU went on the air that year and continued on that frequency until after the war, when I designed and built a 3-tower directional antenna system operating on 790 kilocycles at a new location west of town. But just as the station went on the air in 1937 and the day I was to leave Eau Claire and go home, I became very ill with some kind of diarrhea with fluids pouring out of me in great quantity and none going back in. I became dehydrated in a big way. The fellas kept coming in to see me in the hotel room, and one day they became so alarmed they ran to get a doctor. I was on my way. Everything was so peaceful, and I was floating. If this is death, it ain't all bad. The doctor came to the room and started pumping fluids into me, and I slowly came around. I guess it was not my time to go, as it appears there was much more for me to do in the next 59 years, which is now. In the middle 30s, the city of Superior obtained some federal money with which to expand their little grass strip airport out there on the south side of town. There was a problem. Right off the end of the runway they wanted to extend was the WEBC tower. The federal boys said, "Move that tower or you'll not get any money." So the city of Superior came to us asking us to move our tower. The boss said, "We were there before your airport was built, so you move your airport." But the city said they had too much money invested in their airport by then, so there we all sat glaring at each other. Time went by. In fact, 13 years went by, with all of us talking to each other. Well, not exactly all of us, as I was the only one meeting with city and FAA people. The boss stayed out of it, letting me troop to meeting after meeting. The boss said, "You can always settle an argument by giving in." He never gave in. In the end, the city did find some money, and the WEBC tower and transmitter was moved to a new location way south and in no way interfering with the airport. Of course, at that time, I was not flying, and my sympathy was all with WEBC. Years later, I was flying my plane in and out of their airport, and I was mighty glad WEBC did not have their dirty old tower sticking up there where I wanted to fly. From 1926 and up to the end of World War II, I purchased no broadcasting equipment from any equipment factory. In fact, most of those years there were no factories manufacturing broadcasting equipment. Most radio stations were homemade. We used to visit each other's stations to see how they built theirs. After the war, the broadcasting industry boomed and factories appeared, and from then on, I bought from them and all but closed up my shop. My company shop was located at the site of the WEBC transmitter, and I employed from 1 to 3 mechanics depending on the workload. The one regular was Earl Olson, who could interpret my blueprints and follow my wishes expertly. My shop built every part of the Arrowhead Network transmitters and studio equipment, even the large cabinets housing the transmitters. The transmitters ranged in power from a 2-watt transmitter you could carry on your back for broadcasts from golf links up to 5,000-watt transmitters used at Duluth and Eau Claire. My constant worry was that the boss would order me to build a 50,000-watt transmitter, which seemed a bit beyond me, but I suppose I would have made out somehow. The boss did not keep people around who could not do things. He was a you-do-things kind of a boss. The things you remember. It was just before Christmas in 1937 when a young man by the name of Rolf Erickson came in my office looking for a job. I was impressed by this young chap, and it appeared we did need a man at WHLB in Virginia. So I told him to report for work there right away. He came back in my office 15 minutes later and asked if it'd be all right if he went to work after Christmas, as he would like to be at home with his father and mother on Christmas Day. I said okay, and gave it no further thought. He did go to work at WHLB, and when the war came and he entered the military, I lost track of him. Some years after the war, I heard rumors telling that he was now the top radio personality with a radio station in Chicago, and his name was now Josh Brady. And it was years after that that June and I were in Chicago visiting with my son Roger and his wife Jean, and they took us to a very swank nightclub. As we sat at a dining table, I heard a voice calling, Hello, Charlie. And Josh Brady came to our table, and we chatted about days of long ago. My son and daughter-in-law were so awe-stricken they could hardly speak. Here was the famous Josh Brady they had heard so many times on their radio. To me, he was just Rolf Erickson, a boy just out of school, asking me for a job. But the world does move on. Nothing stays the same.